So, coming off of the passionate argument from Cam for why there absolutely is a right to die, and I'll review the conclusions that Cam reaches about why she thinks there is such a right, we're going to look at David Velleman's argument that is against the right to die, and an argument against the right to die from a non-traditional source of such opposition. Because typically, when you think about the right to die, folks, they are people who believe in the morality of the moral permissibility of euthanasia and PAS. And when you think about individuals who are opposed to the right to die, those are individuals who are against, morally, the physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. Sometimes you can see an argument, you can find an argument that is actually against the legalization of PAS and euthanasia because of certain kinds of social consequences, and that's there. This is a first cousin to that, but you don't typically see folks who are morally opposed and yet don't argue for a right to euthanasia or suicide or physician-assisted suicide. And that's where we find Velleman. He is passionately in favor of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide as long as it's not understood as a right, by which he means by which a circumstance where it would not be federally legal. So he is against the legalization of PAS and euthanasia for a very particular reason, namely that it will set up an expectation against which one will have to argue actively in favor of staying alive. So his argument isn't at all about morality. It's not even about the kinds of concerns people have when they are against legalization for social consequences, namely that the wrong people will commit suicide at the in the face of a terminal illness, namely, you know, people who are poor or people who are depressed or people who are somehow coerced from loved ones. He's not worried that people will make a mistake and die when they felt that it wasn't the right decision for them. He's worried about how people will come to believe that it is the right decision for them, but not from a place of really desiring to have the end of one's life, but against the backdrop of a kind of social expectation that that's simply what people ought to do when they reach a certain stage. So it's a very novel argument, not an argument you see very often, but I think a very subtle one. Okay. First, I'll go through what his argument is. I didn't put this up there, but I'm going to just review the punchline of Cam, just so we bring home what she was trying to do. On Velleman's argument, we will look first at this idea of two concepts, dignity and autonomy, that come from the Kantian tradition, to see if it's the Kantian understanding of those terms, dignity and autonomy, that explain why he is against the right to die. And then we'll understand that it's actually a co-opting of those two terms by bioethics away from the original Kantian meaning that folks use as the anchor for why there ought to be a right to die. So we'll look at the Kantian meaning, we'll look at the bioethics meaning, and we'll see if we can find a justification in dignity and autonomy to anchor the right to die. And he's going to argue there is no anchor, not for the right to die at least. That's not going to negate the fact that he thinks death is sometimes a benefit. It's just that he wants to argue against a right and in favor of permission rather than requirement, and that's where the rest of the argument will hinge. Again, he's not worried about mistakes. He's worried about a new American obligation to have oneself eliminated. He's worried about a new moral burden that will be placed on the very ill to justify their continued existence. And then he's going to take us into a very interesting line of argumentation about options and enable us to think about how having choices and having options can actually harm us, even if we make a decision to reject the option, or even if sometimes the acceptance of the option would actually be a benefit to us. So it's kind of a head scratcher, but I think he's really onto something, and we'll explore some examples that you'll have about what kind of burden there is in being required to actively make a choice about something that prior had not been a choice you were burdened to make. And then we'll look at the question of justifying one's existence and what it means to feel that your life has to rise up to some levels, to meet some bar, in order for you to claim a right to actually be in existence, and how difficult it is in normal circumstances, let alone in very trying or painful or tragic or circumstances or circumstances of suffering, to make a justification like that, and the pressure that will be against the backdrop of your justification for trying to stay alive. Ultimately, he's going to try to address the objection of paternalism, which would be the claim that no one has the right to deny me the right, or that you are acting as if you know better than I do about what decision I want to make for myself. He's going to argue that paternalism is not the right objection. He's probably right. Paternalism is not the right objection, but that doesn't mean there isn't an objection of its ilk, and we'll have to see. And then we'll look at what Velleman proposes as his solution. And as we do that, we want to be thinking about who has access to a solution like that, and whether there isn't a certain kind of discrimination that will be inherent in the Vellemanian solution. Alrighty. So let's talk first about Francis Cam. Very difficult argument, took us most of the class last time. And think about the implications of her argument that there is a right to die. Just getting it summed up. Bottom line is going to be that if you disagree with Cam, and you find that she's argued tightly, and maybe there was some loophole that you see that she doesn't, she believes you're either going to take down pain relief that foresees adverse consequences like death, or you're going to take down withdrawal and withholding. She believes that you can't be consistent in your rejection of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide and still keep both pain relief that foresees death and withdrawal and withholding. The reason that, and maybe you all want to tell me why, so I'll give you that opportunity if you want to explain to us why her argument, she believes, will require that you give up one of these two things, and she believes you don't want to give up either one of those things. So, in other words, the form of her argument was, there is a right to euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide if there is a right to pain relief even if you can foresee death, or if there is a right to have your care withheld or withdrawn at your request when you intend your death. Want to give that a shot? Either one of those? How will you find yourself inconsistent to reject physician-assisted suicide, let's just use that, on the one hand, but argue that you ought to be able to have as much morphine as you need, even if it will potentially depress your respiration and hasten your death? Why does she think you're inconsistent if you try to hold no PAS, yes to pain relief? Not euthanasia pain relief, just pain relief to the point where your pain is controlled, knowing, though, foreseeing that your death could be the sequelae or consequence. That was this is the trickiest of her argumentation, which was very complex.
Does she speak about the lesser evil? Is that what you're trying to get at?
The whole thing is going to hinge on death as a lesser evil, but this is going to involve the radio. Taking down pain relief that foresees death is going to take down
the part of the argument that has to do with the radio. Let me talk us through it. If you buy the Kantian explanation for why there ought not to be physician-assisted suicide, namely that you should not use your body as a means towards some, as a pure means, an instrumental means towards some goal that you have, then allowing your body to be used to extinguish your pain at the cost of your own life means that you are using your body to achieve the end, the goal, of absence of pain, but you're using its very existence as the means to it, because let's make this foresee death a certainty. You can't have your pain controlled without near certainty that your respiration will be depressed. So you, if you get the pain relief, you will. That's not why you're doing it. Of course not. You would like to have the pain relief in this wing without having the consequence of hastening your death, but the doctrine of double effect is about how you will basically sabotage the doctrine of double effect. That's this wing. If you allow pain relief medicines to be given to the point where you can foresee your death, even though it's not what you intend, then you've allowed your body's demise to be the very mechanism that solves your pain problem. So you have used your body in this Kantian way that you're not supposed to use your body as a pure means. You have used your body as a pure means to achieve the end of your pain with the consequence of your death, even though you didn't intend it. So this distinction that the doctrine of double effect makes between foreseeing and intending simply gets dissolved. And now there is no doctrine of double effect that enables you and you as patient or you as clinician to deliver pain relief to the point of the end of pain with the foreseeing of death as a consequence. In other words, it will hamstring you, it will tie your hands behind your back about getting enough pain relief to end enough morphine to end your pain. Because if you're not allowed to use your body as if your argument against physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia is that you can't smash your body, smash the radio, to end your pain by physician-assisted suicide or by euthanasia, then you can't smash your body, smash the radio, to get pain relief. Doesn't matter that you're in the foreseeing wing. You're still using your own body to meet a certain goal, either the end of your pain, the end of your life. You're using your body. So what she's trying to argue here is that if you're a pure Kantian and you are worried about the objection that has historically been made ever since Kant wrote the second formula of the categorical imperative, that you're not supposed to use your own self as a pure means to some goal you have, then you can't use yourself as a pure means to hasten your death, which would be the intending side, or you can't use your own body to end your pain because you're doing the exact same thing. Doesn't matter that you're only foreseeing your death, you're using your body purely to get to a goal, namely the end of your pain. In the end, whether you use your body to die or use your body's fragility to end your pain, either way, you've made your body into a pure means for some goal, namely whatever goal you set up, either the end of pain or the end of your life. So if you care about Kantianism, strict Kantian rationale, you can neither have physician-assisted suicide, nor euthanasia, nor pain relief that foresees your death. All cases make your body's fragility an instrument of your nefarious purpose, a single end of either ending your pain, in this case, or ending your life, in the case of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. Very complex argument that ultimately tries to say this: if you're a Kantian, it's all fine to be a Kantian. But then no, you can neither get morphine that will foresee your death, nor PAS or euthanasia that will foresee your death. I mean, that will intend your death. Doesn't matter, because your pain relief that foresees your death is still using your body in the exact same pure instrumental way that your swallowing the barbiturates uses your body to bring about the goal of ending life. I can see a lot of fuzzy. It's so clear to me, but I don't think I'm getting it across. Let's try it like this. Pain relief to end pain or PAS, to end life. These are your goals. This is the use of your body. This is the pure use of your body to reach a goal or an end, as Kantians like to say. The idea is that you are not supposed to treat your personhood, your body, as just an instrument to reach a goal. You have to treat yourself as a pure end in itself, not just use the body as an instrumental mechanism to achieve some goal that you have. So if you made a chart here and you talked about something that was some act that was just pure use for some goal that you set up, getting pain relief to end pain that destroys the body is no different than PAS that has the goal of ending life and destroys the body. In both cases, you are using your body, you're destroying your body for a goal. And that is against the Kantian second categorical imperative. She doesn't care about the Kantian second categorical imperative. She doesn't care. She's only speaking to those of you who believe so fervently in the Kantian rejection of PAS and euthanasia that you have rejected the right to physicians, the right to assisted death, because she believes that if you are against PAS for this reason, you have to be against that level of morphine for the same reason. That's all. She's just asking you to be consistent. So just as a summary, if the reason that you reject physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia is because your Kantian second categorical imperative does not allow you to think that your body should be used pure for some pure instrumental good, therefore you can't have PAS. She wants you to understand, consistency-wise, you can't get morphine for pain relief that foresees your death to end pain either. So you've taken out pain relief with PAS and euthanasia on the Kantian ground. And that's probably true, because Kant probably doesn't think that you should have that much pain relief that would risk your respiration. He does not employ the doctrine of double effect. He just doesn't. He doesn't come from that tradition. That comes from the Catholic theological tradition. It does not come from the Kantian tradition. So Kant himself is consistent. He probably wouldn't let you have that much morphine. And 50 years ago, either would anybody here. They wouldn't have employed the doctrine of double effect here, and they would have under-medicated you. So she's speaking to people who think they can have both of these things on the grounds of the doctrine of double effect. And she wants to say you cannot. Not on the ground. If this is the reason you reject PAS, you can't have pain relief.
But even without death, you're still using your body as a means to end your pain, so that's still not...
No, if it doesn't foresee death, so if for example, a Tylenol does not foresee your death. Two tablets of it, of course,
right.
The whole bottle does, right? But one dosage of Tylenol does not in any way foresee your death. Otherwise, it wouldn't be over the counter. So it does not foresee your death. You're absolutely able to take it. You can have 600 milligrams of Motrin, absolutely, because it doesn't foresee your death. But any kind level of pain relief that really foresees your death, that is using your body for the goal of ending your pain, knowing you're going to die to do it. Okay. Yep.
There was a case of somebody who went to dentist, and to relieve the pain, of course, to the dental work, they used anesthesia. The dentist didn't know that this person had a heart problem. And this person, the next day, died.
That is an accidental death. That is not part of this equation at all, because that... What we're understanding about this particular dentist is he did not foresee her death at all. Accidents happen, right? We sometimes drive down a road and we didn't know that there was someone in the road because it was dark and they were wearing a dark jacket and they weren't in a crosswalk and we hit them. So too, now maybe a dentist had an obligation to ask, but let's run the case that this woman who's getting the dental work did not know she had an allergy to anesthesia. There's no culpability there. I have an obligation as a practitioner to ask you, but if you don't know or you don't tell me, then my culpability, I don't have any culpability there. It's the same as you ran across the street in a dark jacket in the dark and I hit you. I have no culpability. As long as I was in the speed limit, you weren't in the crosswalk, there was no way I could see you. So your case isn't one of these. It's not that death happens. It's that death was foreseen. If death was foreseen and you did it anyway because you had a bigger goal,
than staying alive, namely getting rid of your pain, then you have tried to use the doctrine of double effect, and she wants to assure you, you can't have the doctrine of double effect on morphine for pain relief and then say that you're against PAS. On the Kantian grounds, you might have some other argument for arguing that you like, you don't like PAS, but you do like morphine for pain relief. You may have another argument that's not the Kantian second categorical imperative, but what she wants to argue here is that you, if you are arguing on basis of doctrine of double effect that you should have pain relief that precedes death, you cannot then say that you reject PAS on those same grounds.
If you're of the Kantian school of thought, what is a person supposed to do? Just be in agony for weeks and weeks? Is there a hope of a miracle, or that's just the way it is, and they don't want to use their body as pure means, so they just live with the pain and or hope for a miracle?
Yeah. Well, they just as practitioners did here, for most of American medical history, they don't give you so much that they think they're risking your respiration. So that if your respiration, and Josh had outlined a whole bunch of signals that you get to show that, oh gosh, we're starting to put respiration in danger, you just back off on the morphine. You just don't let your life be in jeopardy based on the morphine that you're being given. That's the limitation of the pain relief you can get. I'm not advocating it, and believe me, plenty of Kantians just think that there are ways of understanding that the second categorical imperative may be true here, but there may be some other moral obligation to yourself, like the obligation to develop your own talents or to have a certain type of personhood that pain actually eliminates. There's other trumping mechanisms. So. Go ahead.
Doesn't Kim also make an argument, though, that is sort of non-Kantian that just that at some point the doctrine of dual effect just sort of merges? And
That's the second one. So then we have the so if you, yes. Now she takes on the intention wing. This is the 4C wing of the doctrine of double effect. It involves the morphine, bolus, that is not intending to kill you, but will kill you. Foresees that it will kill you, but is not trying to kill you. Then she goes after the intention side of the doctrine of double effect, and she says, if your problem, you think, with PAS and euthanasia is that you only think the foresee wing of the doctrine of double effect is morally valid, and that once you're in the intention side of the I intend someone's death wing of the doctrine of double effect, you're on shaky moral ground. If that's your view, foresee yes, intend no, then she wants you to admit that you're a hypocrite, because withdrawing and withholding, certainly withdrawing and usually, often withholding, are precisely done with the intention of hastening death. So fine, if you say, I believe in the foresee wing, this is Cass, I do not think it's morally permissible to be on the intention side. Great. Bye-bye most cases of withholding and withdraw. So then you've lost withholding and withdraw. What she's trying to do is say, she doesn't care what your beliefs are, but please be consistent. If you think the Kantian pure use argument is really powerful, then you don't get pain relief when your death is foreseen. If you believe that the doctrine of double effect foresee wing is morally permissible, but intend wing is not, bye-bye withhold and withdraw. So you make your choices. Cass makes his choice. He believes with inconsistency with the second, and actually the first, that it'd be interesting to know whether he would agree with the first wing of the doctrine of this dilemma, of this conundrum. My guess is he might be okay with this, because he's not really a Kantian. But at this one, he's certainly willing to swallow. He's willing to give up withholding and withdrawing if it's on the intention side of the doctrine of double effect. In other words, if the reason that I am withholding or withdrawing care on my loved one is because we've all decided it's time to just let this person go, let's just bring this to a close, then she's arguing that you accept the intention part of the doctrine of double effect for withhold and withdraw, and then why wouldn't you accept the intention wing of the doctrine of double effect for PAS and euthanasia? So in summary, what she's arguing about is you can hold either one of these positions in rejection of PAS or euthanasia, but you can't do it without a cost. you're going to have a cost of taking withholding and withdrawing down with you, or you're going to have it at the cost of pain relief when you foresee death.
If you reject.
Yeah, well, if you accept it, then you've
you
got
it all. Everything.
Absolutely, it's all good. Okay, right. And that brings us to Velleman. Velleman knows his CAM. He is very persuaded by arguments like this. Because here's the rub. He's not morally opposed. This is not an argument about legality or about policy. This is an argument exclusively about morality. And Velleman agrees with CAM that it is morally permissible. And in that sense of a moral right, he has no problem with it.